Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. And thank you very much for coming. Did any of you happen to walk past the crowd gathering for the City to Surf over there? A great pile of energy available there. 80,000 people gathered together for a single venture. But thank you for giving that up and being here this morning. Now, this is not going to be a slideshow. We're just going to use the screen a little bit later on for a small film clip. But welcome, and thank you very much for the effort that you've made to be here. This is the second of our breathing space modules, and the purpose of these modules is very simple. It's just to stimulate wonder. Noah's Ark is the title of today's talk, and it's about knowledge. Noah's Ark. But when you say it, it doesn't sound like it should be about knowledge. It sounds like it should be about somebody called Noah from the Old Testament. Now, Noah was 600 years old when he started to build his ark. 600 years old. He had three sons when he was 500, so he had to sort of wait till they grew up a little bit. And at 600, he started building his ark. Now, his ark was a boat that was built against the flood. He knew something that his neighbours didn't know. And on the back of that knowledge, he built the ark. Now, it must have been some kind of knowledge. He had to use all of his spare time to build this great big boat in his backyard. He had to gather all the materials for it. He had to find out how to build it. And according to Bill Cosby, he actually had to find out what a cubit was so that he could measure it. And then he had to go all over the world and gather two of every kind of animal to bring into the ark. And every one of those he had to bring back home and park in his backyard until the ark was finished and it was time for them to go on. But the first thing that he had to do, now this is really serious knowledge that motivates somebody to undertake something like that. But the first thing that he had to do, of course, was to break the news to his wife. And you don't break that kind of news to your wife unless you really, really know what you're doing. You usually ask your wife's permission before you undertake something like that. But he had to break the news to his wife, so it must have been some serious knowledge that he was working under. Motivational knowledge. By the time he'd finished building the ark, he'd signed an agreement with God. He'd packed the ark with the male and female of every living being, and then the rains came. 40 days and 40 nights of torrential downpour. And at the end, when the floodwaters had subsided, the rains were over, and the ark was emptied of all of its creatures. God promised that he'd never, ever do it again. He signed another agreement with Noah. And this time, God signed the agreement with a rainbow. Now, what the Old Testament says, and God said, "This is the token of the covenant which I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you, for perpetual generations. I do set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be for a token of a covenant between me and the earth. And it shall come to pass when I bring a cloud over the earth, that the bow shall be seen in the cloud." A rainbow. A multicoloured arc stretching across the sky. Now, every time we see a rainbow, it raises our spirits. It's a natural response to it, particularly if you see a whole rainbow after a bit of a storm. So this arc stretched across the sky. Now, Noah's Ark, A-R-K, the arc of a rainbow, A-R-C. And under the arc of that rainbow, the world was remade. Now, in the same way, we build our lives under an arc of knowledge. And what we're here to wonder about this morning is what that knowledge is and what the best part of it is. Now, a rainbow is a really magical thing. And like people in the Old Testament, the ancient Greeks also saw the rainbow as something really significant. For them, a rainbow was a bridge between heaven and earth. It was a link between man on the earth and the gods in heaven. And over that bridge, man could enter the realm of the gods and know about their world, and through the rainbow, the gods could make their presence known among men. Now, the rainbow was the child of a god called Thaumas. Thaumas. It's one of the old gods, not the Olympian gods. The rainbow was one of two children that Thaumas had. And Thaumas, in English, is the word wonder. So for the ancient Greeks, the experience of wonder was manifest in the physical world as a rainbow. So this rainbow, it's an arc in the sky, it's a sign of peace after a storm, it's a bridge to knowledge of the gods, and it's a child of wonder. Now we're here to wonder about knowledge, so let's start that, and maybe we can climb a rainbow. Now those who are here at the last Breathing Space module were introduced to this process of wondering with a series of questions, and we're going to do the same thing this morning. Wonder is the beginning of philosophy. You start by wondering about things, you proceed through inquiry, and with any luck, if the wondering has worked, you end in a state of suspended quiet, in wonder about the thing that you've been inquiring into. So we're going to start with some questions, because wondering begins with questions. Now, don't try and answer these questions. The thing is just to consider them. And if you see me stumbling over cords here and it looks like I'm about to pull everything over, please alert me to it. We'll start with Noah. Now, Noah built his ark because he knew something, and that knowledge was motivational. Now, I expect that every single person in this room has at some stage or another been moved to shape their lives in a particular way by motivational knowledge of some kind. We've decided to take a course of action through some kind of knowledge. We've known about something that we needed to do. Now, don't worry about the thing that we needed to do. But what was it that changed the shape of our lives? What did you know at the time? Really know? What did that knowledge, that thing, feel like? It was so strong that it moved you to completely change the direction of your life. Well, perhaps not completely, but certainly make a significant move. You knew something. What did it feel like? Knowledge is often described as being of different types. What do all these different types of knowledge have in common? Knowledge of a skill, like carpentry, or a martial art, or neurosurgery. Knowledge of a skill. What's that got in common with knowledge of an art, like music, or dance, or sculptor? What's that got in common with knowledge of the mind, like mathematics or grammar? Knowledge of the world, like economics or politics or law? What do all these things have in common that we call knowledge? Knowledge of good and evil. Self-knowledge. What's the core element that they're all called by the word of knowledge? Third question. Is information the same as knowledge? Is learning about a place the same as being there? You can read all the books you like about the Holocaust, but to visit one of the death camps and to see the container after container of shoes, no amount of reading can connect you with that. Is information the same as knowledge? Is watching a film about love Is that the same as knowing love? Is information the same as knowledge? Is having an idea about yourself the same as knowing yourself? So that's the third question. Fourth one. What about belief? Is belief the same as knowledge? What do you believe to be true, but don't know? What do you believe to be true, but can't prove? Is proof the same as knowledge? What about opinion? Is opinion the same as knowledge? Well, what's your opinion about the current election? Now, what's opinion for? Is it to encourage disputes or to foster inquiry? To question things or to find answers? Do opinions lead to knowledge or do they block knowledge? Next question. What did you learn as a child on your mother's or your father's knee? How did they deliver this knowledge? How did you receive it? Do you still know it now? Do you remember a teacher that you had that had a profound effect on you? What was it that they taught you? Was the knowledge that you received from them more important than the information that you received from them? Do you still remember the details of that geography lesson or the history lesson or the English lesson? Or is there something else? Next question. Understanding. Does understanding come before or after knowledge? Does realization come before or after knowledge? Is it better to be understood or to understand? Next one, second last one. When did knowledge begin? Does it only begin when I know something? Does it end when I forget? Where does it come from before I think of it? Where does it go when I forget? And the final question. Is there any difference between knowledge and love? Can you really know anything or anyone without love? Can you really love anyone or anything without knowledge? Is it better to have love of knowledge or knowledge of love? Now, questions like this open the mind. And with an open mind, we're ready to move forward. An open mind is the beginning of knowledge. You can't receive anything with a clenched fist. It needs to be opened. And an open mind is the beginning of knowledge. Now, if we fill our minds with all of the dust of information, data dust, fill it with data dust, and all you've got is the doors of perception closed and a mind full of movement. So the first gift of wondering is to open the mind. That's the first gift of it. And with an open mind, we can proceed with an inquiry. Socrates liked speaking with young people for this very reason, because their minds were open. And he hoped to tap the source of knowledge itself by asking them questions. Now, a lot of people think that Socrates' question and answer method was a setup. People tend to think that he knew what he was asking about, and so he was just trying to trap people into a particular conclusion. But if you read Socrates in a different way, read Socrates as if he doesn't know and he's really asking, it's a different matter. Now, when you engage in Socratic dialogue, one of the first things that you have to master is the ability to answer a question. Now, just think about the dinner table when you're at a dinner party and the conversation is going really well and it comes to the election. And you make a statement, and then somebody asks you a question. Now, our usual response is to defend our point of view, to make the question appear ridiculous, to give it an answer perhaps, but certainly an answer that's going to quieten the questioner rather than open up a conversation. So this capacity to be open to questions is quite a capacity. Now, Socrates knew that young people were open to questions. So he'd engage in these conversations with them. So in one spring day, in 399 BC, he was sitting in one of the outer courts and he had a conversation with a young fellow called Theaetetus. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce it. Theaetetus. We'll stick with that. And this fellow was a promising young geometrician. He also had an interest in philosophy. And Socrates starts off by saying this to him. There's three or four of them sitting down there, and they've had this preamble, and Socrates starts by asking him, there's a little difficulty which I want you and the company to aid me in investigating. Will you answer me a question? Is not learning growing wiser about that which you learn? Is it true that learning should be growing wiser about the thing that you're learning about? And there's general agreement. And then he asks, well, is it true that it's through wisdom that the wise are wise? And they consider that, and they agree. And he asks, well, is that different in any way at all from knowledge? And they query that, they don't understand. And he says, well, wisdom, are not men wise in that which they know? Wise in that which they know. And they agree. So his conclusion is, herein lies the difficulty which I can never solve to my satisfaction. What is knowledge? Can we answer that question? What say you? So there's Socrates, the wisest man in all Greece by reputation, asking what is knowledge? So he's really straight with the question. Now the ironic thing about this dialogue, the Theaetetus, is that at the end, everybody comes to the conclusion that they haven't come to a conclusion. But what's valuable is the process that they go through. Because the process that they go through opens the mind and clears it of opinions and beliefs that block the inquiry. There's a young man he's talking to. Now, he didn't want to know how we know anything. This is really important. But what knowledge itself is. He wants to know the very nature of knowledge, and that's his question. Now, remember that Socrates is speaking with a young man. And by the way, this young man is described as having a really fabulous mind, a good, clear mind, and a very strong character. He's not particularly handsome, by all reports, but he has a remarkable character for a young man of his age. He's about 17 or 18, and a remarkable mind. So he's speaking with this young man, and the young man starts to answer Socrates' question, what is knowledge? without too much thought of wisdom. And this is good for us because we've got all sorts of ideas about knowledge and about wisdom and about learning, and we have to get our way clear. So we're going to follow their method. But just to get this really, really straight, Socrates starts off by saying that knowledge is the same as wisdom. We got that? That learning is about becoming more wise. Now, when you did your HSC after 12 years of education, were you wise? When you did your Bachelor of Science degree or your PhD in neurosurgery and you've done all that learning, were you wise? So this is quite a radical definition of what learning is about. It's a radical definition about knowledge. But Theaetetus, a young man, doesn't notice that. He's still on the idea of knowledge. So we're going to follow the thread. Exactly the same pattern. We're here to wonder about knowledge, not how we know, or what we know, or even if we know, but what knowledge is in itself. But in order to get there, we need to go through some of the processes that Socrates went through with Theaetetus. What do you know? Now you could say those four words another way. What do you know? What do you know? Same four words, three different meanings. If you read it on a page, unless you had a description somewhere, you wouldn't know any difference. But through the sense of hearing, we discern a different meaning with every one of them. What do you know? What do you know? What do you know? A completely different ground for each one of them, and it's through the sense of hearing. So the sense of hearing, combined with experience, gives each sentence a different meaning. Now, language is the most remarkable thing. Now, if you think about it, here's this little squirming ball of humanity demanding food that meets us when it's born. And over a short period of time, without grammar textbooks, without a Berlitz language course, without any kind of formal instruction at all, just through the sense of hearing, this being, like us all, has mastered probably the most complex activity that a being could undertake. Language. Just through the sense of hearing. So it's a remarkable sense. So clearly, one of the ways that we gain knowledge is through the senses. There are five of them, and we gain knowledge through the senses. Now, generally speaking, philosophy, academic philosophy, has a branch called epistemology. Well, we're not going to get into this too much because it was a word that was invented by a Scottish philosopher in the 19th century and is made up of two Greek words, episteme and logos. Episteme means to know and logos is science. So this branch of academic philosophy called the science of knowing or knowledge, epistemology. There's another Greek word they've got for all sorts of other branches. But academic philosophy recognises four basic sources of knowledge. Perception, testimony, the testimony of others. For example, what's your name? How do you know? How much knowledge have we gained through the testimony of others? The third one, inference. Where there's smoke, we infer fire. And that's a valid form of knowledge. And the fourth one, logical argument. So perception, testimony, inference, logical argument. We write on those four. They're pretty straightforward. This is about as technical as we're going to get this morning. So they're four basic sources of knowledge. Now, out of those four, which one do we depend on the most? So we're walking down the street and we see something that we want, and of course that sense perception triggering desire. The desire is then brought to the silent tribunal of logical analysis, isn't it? Every single time. Absolutely. So logical analysis isn't our usual approach to securing knowledge. Inference happens automatically and sometimes unconsciously. But every one of these four has major flaws. Let's start with the senses. Our senses are not reliable sources of knowledge. If we relied on our senses as a source of knowledge, we'd think that the sun moved around the earth. If we relied on our senses as a valid source of knowledge, we'd see water in a desert in the distance and we'd run to get a drink until we got close enough to realize that it had disappeared. If we had knowledge of a mirage, then we wouldn't be deceived by the eyes. But our senses are not reliable sources of knowledge. What about the testimony of others? A whole nation relied upon the testimony of Pol Pot in Cambodia, and the result was the killing fields. Stalin in Russia, Hitler in Germany. It's not a completely valid source of knowledge. If we relied solely upon the testimony of others, we'd choose Coca-Cola because it's real. We'd choose Toyotas because they make us feel better. We'd choose Preen because it, whatever it does to clothes. And we'd think that banks were our very best friends. So the testimony of others is not always reliable. We can't. But what about inference? Now imagine this. I'm walking towards a group of friends in a room. It's a quiet evening. I hear them talking. I hesitate outside the door and listen to what they're saying. And they're saying the most awful things about me. Backbiting, critical, nasty, awful things. And I stand there and listen for a little while. I can't bear it anymore, so I go away. But I can't sleep that night, and all the next day I'm subjected to misery. I think about what I'm going to do. I'll go away and join the Foreign Legion. I'll move to Tierra del Fuego. I'll die and watch them at the funeral as they feel really sorry about what they said about me. And it's so awful that I finally go up to them and I ask them about it. And guess what? They weren't talking about me at all. I'd drawn the wrong inference from the wrong sense information. I'm so relieved that I joined them in talking about this other person because I've got a lot to say about the world. So inference isn't reliable. Well, what about logical argument? Now, in order to look at this one, we've got a short film clip, and I hope this is going to kick in fairly quickly for us. Logical argument is one of those things that we tend to rely on a lot, particularly academically. We tend to think that if you can argue a point of view systematically and prove it logically, then you've won the day. One of the things that Socrates loathed, although loathing is a strong word and he would never have manifested loathing as hatred, but one of the things that he was opposed to in Greece were a group of itinerant intellectuals who taught for money. Now knowledge, real knowledge, doesn't belong to anybody, so it can't be sold. But these itinerant intellectuals taught people how to argue, how to persuade others of a truth that they wanted them to know about. They were called sophists, from the Greek word sophia, wisdom. They claimed to be wise about what they taught. Now, these sophists have matured into our modern-day sophisticates. And sophistication has some good press and some bad press.
For copyright reasons, we are unable to reproduce Abbott and Costello's routine from their film In the Navy.
So there we have it. Now, there's obviously a problem with his mathematics. Was there a hook there or not? What do your senses tell you? Well, the hat stayed up, so by inference, the hook was really there. But was that mathematics, that logical deduction, was that flawed or brilliant? On the one hand, from the character's point of view, it was really flawed. But what about the scriptwriter? That was really quite brilliant. So academic philosophy gives us these four sources of knowledge, and every one of them are flawed. They're unreliable in themselves. By themselves, they don't give knowledge. The four of them only provide information. That's all they do. And they need something else to make them useful as knowledge. By themselves, they cannot accrue as wisdom. Otherwise, the internet would be wise. There's something which we know, which is independent of those four: perception, inference, testimony, logical deduction. There's something that we know which is completely independent, and it is knowledge of our existence. We know that we exist. Now, the mind can come up with all sorts of clever little twists and turns on that, but we know that we exist. And let's test this now. And we're going to start with right where we are, right here and now. We're going to use a simple reflection exercise, which I first came across in an introductory course in the school. So just make sure that you're relaxed and at ease, and we're going to run through this reflection. Consider this. Where are we? We're sitting in a room in Hyde Park Towers. This building is one of a number of buildings in Elizabeth Street. The street is one of many streets in the neighbourhood, one of many in the city of Sydney. Beyond the city lie the suburbs of a sprawling metropolis. Beyond this city is the wider state of New South Wales, a small part of the continent of Australia. And beyond Australia lie the countries of the earth. Beyond the earth, the moon and the planets, and beyond the planets, the sun, and beyond the sun, the galaxy, and beyond the galaxy, many, many, many galaxies, new ones, more distant ones being discovered all the time. As our view extends, we shrink and disappear. Where are we? We're in a morning in August in the year 2010. Behind us and before us stretch the days and the weeks and the months and the years and the centuries and the millennia and the pregnant instant of creation. Where are we? Whichever way we look, the universe extends beyond imagination. Where are we? Now, wherever we are, there is something we know with complete certainty. We know that we are. We know that we exist. And this knowledge of existence, this I am, is independent of any other agency than knowledge itself. It needs nothing else. This simple focus of the attention on the present moment, here and now, with a broadness of vision, breaks us free from our usual identification with being somebody in particular, in a particular state of mind, having particular feelings. And throughout all that is this feeling of existence. No one can ever take that away from us. When we're completely ourselves, bright and clear and completely free of doubt, everything that the senses and the mind present to us as information is tested against this knowledge of existence. The measure of truth in anything is tested against the truth of this existence. Every impression, every single movement of the mind is dealt with according to the measure of truth it contains. Every human being has this power of reason, and it's reason which measures the truth of anything. Every single person has it. You don't go to university to get reason. You're born with it. If reason is strong in the knowledge of pure existence, then reasoning is strong. And its measures, the activity of reasoning, are really accurate. If reason is weak, then reasoning is weak, and the measures are faulty. So it's a natural function of the mind. Shakespeare's Hamlet says, "What is a man if his chief good and market of his time is but to sleep and feed? A beast, no more. Sure, he that made us with such large discourse, looking before and after, gave us not that capability and godlike reason to waste in us unused." Now, in the Vedantic tradition, that aspect of mind, which we call reason, is called buddhi. It's a beautiful word, buddhi. It's that aspect of mind which measures the truth in anything, and everyone has it. Its very strength depends on its connection with the purity of existence. If this godlike buddhi isn't connected with existence, it's weak. And this can be seen very simply in what we lend the power of existence to. If we identify ourselves with anything less than what we really are, then buddhi will be limited by the identity that we take. If we think we're a lawyer, if we think we're a carpenter, if we think that we're a wife, if we think that we're a husband, if we think that we're a weakling, then the great power of reason, of buddhi, will operate for a lawyer, for a carpenter, for a wife, for a husband, for a weakling. It will serve that identity. Our reasoning will be limited to the identity that we take. In one of the Upanishads, a great householder called Shaunaka puts this question to a master teacher called Angiras. What is that thing which, having been known, everything becomes known? Now that is a glorious question. What is that thing which, having been known, everything becomes known? Angiras gives him an answer. He tells him that there's two kinds of knowledge, and both need to be acquired. A higher knowledge and a lower knowledge. A lower knowledge includes knowledge of the law, lower knowledge. Knowledge of economics, lower knowledge. Knowledge of science, lower knowledge. Knowledge of mathematics, lower knowledge. Knowledge of phonetics and phonology, lower knowledge. Knowledge of grammar, lower knowledge. Knowledge of etymology, lower knowledge. Knowledge of meter, lower knowledge. Knowledge of astronomy, lower knowledge. Everything that you can think of, lower knowledge. And it is to be acquired. Higher knowledge is knowledge of the self. Angiras tells Shaunaka that through knowledge of the self he will realize the truth of everything. Now, self-knowledge is more than knowledge of personality, though this knowledge is included. Self-knowledge is more than knowledge of what one's function is in the world, though this is also included. Self-knowledge is more than knowledge of what one should do and what one shouldn't do, but this knowledge is also included. Self-knowledge is knowledge of what we really and truly are. When we're completely free from any form of identification, it's conscious realization of our unity with the self of all. Angiras tells Shaunaka that knowledge of the self, through it, the wise realize everywhere that which cannot be perceived and grasped, that which is without source, that which is without features, eyes and ears, which has neither hands nor feet, which is eternal, multiformed, all-pervasive, extremely subtle and undiminishing, and which is the source of all. Knowledge of the self gives knowledge of that. Now that injunction, know thyself, was carved into the forecourt of the Temple of Apollo at Delphi. It's a universal instruction, and our capacity as human beings depends upon its fulfillment. Our Western acquisitive culture sees knowledge as information to be collected, stored, marked off. That's dust. Now, that's not to be too dismissive of it, because all that mastery of lower knowledge is an essential part of living. But to attribute to that power, force of transformation, is simply an error. But it's a huge error. So we train our children in it, thinking that we're giving them the greatest gift that we could possibly give them. And all we're doing is foisting upon them centuries of data. And at the end of all that learning, are they wise? Are we wise? We're confused. We don't know who we are, where we're going, what we're meant to do. We don't know what a man is or a woman is. Lower knowledge needs higher knowledge to be of any use. How can this instruction from Angiras be followed? The Vedantic tradition prescribes 7 steps on the way of knowledge, and it's all right, we're not going to work comprehensively through all 7 of them in the next 5 minutes. Somebody in the school here in Sydney has actually written a book which is on sale out there on the 7 steps of knowledge, but very simply, these 7 steps aren't like sort of diplomas that you get. And we'll just get a little taste of them. They're ways of knowing. They're, in a way, they're embodiments of what is known. So the first step is called Shubhechcha, is the Sanskrit word. Each step describes the way that buddhi perceives the world with the change in the identification with existence. Now, Shubhechcha means good influence. It's when some sort of good influence strikes us, which rouses us from what Shakespeare calls our sleeping and feeding. Something rouses our memory. It's sort of feeling that there must be something more. There must be something bright and free. And that influence on us might be a book, a passage in a book, a glimpse of absolute beauty somewhere. Some reminder strikes us. A kind gesture from a blessed soul, it can be anything. But once it happens, there's a new kind of knowledge operating and the buddhi starts to see things differently. There is something more. And then there's commitment and resolution and we discover a way to move forward. Now, if we proceed, if a person on the way of knowledge proceeds like this, the second step, he sees what needs to be done and he works to do it. With that knowledge, he engages in serious inquiry. His world starts to grow larger. As reason grows stronger, his world gets larger. The habitual activities of the mind start to fall away. Perception starts to clear. And this is the time for acting on new knowledge and feeling the beginning of a newfound freedom. Now, the remaining 3 steps we'll leave for now. But there is each step is a step towards this expansion of the world. The final step is called Turiya. And in that step, there's no division between a knower, knowing, and known. All is one. Now, we've done really well. We're almost there. There's one more thing. Everything that we need for this journey forward, to build this arc of knowledge so that we live a flourishing, fulfilling life, all that we need is given to us already. We're fully equipped. We have the power of buddhi. That does need to be nourished and strengthened. It's strengthened with true knowledge and good company through inquiry and practice. So this faculty of reason is strengthened through true knowledge and good company with practice and application. Now this application, knowledge, needs to be put into practice by a conscious, willing agent. And when we wake up to this, we start to feel the strength of where we're at. And it acts as a great encouragement. We start to discern that which is truly real from that which is not real. We start to discern that which we truly value from that which is of only passing interest. This is the active force of buddhi. In Sanskrit, it's called viveka. Viveka. discrimination between the real and the unreal. It needs to be awakened, and once it's awakened, it kindles the fire of knowledge. There's a beautiful verse in a short work by Shankara called the Viveka Chudamani, and it describes knowledge being kindled by a discernment between the real and the unreal. Now, when this knowledge, this wisdom, is kindled like a great fire, it burns and destroys ignorance together with its root, and it shines a great light on the world. Every one of us has had an experience of sudden awareness of something, of the wisdom light shooting up, is one way that one of the Upanishads describe it. Now that light is a shadow of the reflection of the brilliance of knowledge when it's kindled by Viveka. It's utterly purifying, utterly cleansing, and utterly liberating. Now, in the end, it falls to the individual. Only the individual can choose, only the individual can desire. No group can do this for us, no institution can do this for us. The individual can choose, the individual can desire, and only the individual can consciously and actively engage in discrimination. Now, I'm going to stop there. I could go on for another 45 minutes, 3 hours, 5 hours, but I think we'll stop there and have some refreshment, and we'll come back for some questions and answers afterwards. Thank you very much. Thank you.